Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
The issue of Islamic immigration to Europe has gained recent attention in political and academic circles over the past decade. Whereas immigrants from primarily Muslim countries have been around for decades, their growing presence, including second and third generations of migrant families, have sparked debate over how best to incorporate them into European society. This issue is all the more salient, given that Europe is seen as an increasingly secular region of the world, and Muslim immigrants and their children often retain strong religious loyalties and practices. Nor does Islam conform easily to the traditional form of church-state relations favored by most European nations, wherein a hierarchical religious structure is highly regulated and oftentimes funded by the government. In recent years, tension between Muslims and European governments have played out in very visible policy decisions. The French government banned Muslim girls from wearing the hijab, or headscarf, in public schools. And various governments from Switzerland to Germany have blocked the construction of mosques or the minarets associated with these buildings. The tense policy situation has not been eased by some highly publicized events such as the assassination of filmmaker Theo van Gogh by an Islamic radical and by the controversy surrounding cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. To help us sort out what is going on in Europe with respect to this issue, I am pleased to be joined today by Amit Karu, assistant professor of political science at San Diego State University and author of Secularism and State Policies Toward Religion from Cambridge University Press, a book that looks comparatively at the United States, France, and Turkey. This book was based upon his dissertation at the University of Washington, I might add, and it won the prestigious Wildavsky Award from the American Political Science Association. Should also be noted that Amit is the current president of the Religion and Politics section for the APSA. Amit, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's see. The history of the Islamic world and Christian Europe has been really intermingled for at least 1,400 years, and we could really dig back deep into that history if we wanted to today. But I really want to focus on what has gone on in recent decades, the contemporary period here, perhaps dating back to the immediate post-World War II era, the late 1940s, 1950s. Could you give us a sense of the historical background of what has been happening in terms of Muslim immigration since World War II?
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, the history goes back centuries. And some scholars, therefore, argue that actually the Mediterranean area, since the time of the Roman Empire, constituted a one geographic unit. Mm-hmm. And even after the certain wars between Byzantine Empire and the Muslim states, etc., the interactions going on, and it created a by and large shared culture between the Christian Europe and not Middle Eastern, but Muslims all around different parts of the area, including Spain. For centuries they ruled Spain. And that's why Columbia University's historian called it Islam a Christian civilization in the Mediterranean area. But since that time there were many wars, and then the recent immigration changed the attitudes of the two groups between to each other. And what happened in the aftermath of the Second World War was that actually the European states, who were very willing and volunteering to ask immigrants to come and to help the rebuilding of European economies, which were by and large destroyed after during the Second World War.
And that's probably also related to the fact that there were pretty severe labor shortages after World
War
II.
Yeah. Yes. Generally, states follow the post-colonial trajectories. For example, in the United Kingdom, it was mostly Pakistani, Indian, and Bangladeshi Muslims who came because they were former British colonies. In the French case, it was mostly Algerians and Tunisians. And Germany was not a colonial empire, but it had strong ties with Turkey because they were the cooperative the British case, since Pakistan and Bangladesh and Indian Muslims already part of the Commonwealth, it was easier to receive citizenship for them in the UK. Therefore, yes, there are common trends for all European countries, but at the same time, there were variances and different policies. So, but, you know, then in the first generation, although it was temporary, then people had their children, and then the laws changed, and the second generation, and especially left, there is a big difference between left-wing and right-wing governments in European countries.
Let me stop you there and talk about this issue of the temporary citizenship. And you mentioned here that in Britain it was much easier to get full citizenship because if you were part of the British Empire in Pakistan or Bangladesh, you had your citizen transferred over, so that wasn't that big of a problem. But in a place like Germany, it was envisioned that Turkish workers would be there for just, what, 5 or 10 years, and they would go home?
Yes, exactly, because, you know, in political science, there is a general idea that countries like France embrace the territorial citizenship, whereas Germany is an example where the blood ties and ethnicity is important, and it was really reflected in their laws in citizenship. In addition to UK, in France, too, it was easier for Algerians and Tunisians because they were once part of the French colonial empire, and the idea of citizenship in France was based on language and territory. It wasn't the case in Germany. It was mostly ethnic. Therefore, a German in the Soviet Union could have been easily moved to Germany and became a German citizen because of her ethnic background, which is not the case for a Turk, that's different ethnicity. But in 1992, they had a big change in Germany. At the time, there was a left-wing government in power. And then they pushed the agenda for at least the local-born Turks to get the citizenship, and they succeeded. Mm-hmm. For the last 20 years, the debate didn't end, and just a few months ago, Merkel, right now the right-wing prime minister from Christian Democratic Coalition, she announced that multiculturalism failed in Germany. It's hard to understand what she meant by that, because her party opposed multiculturalism from the beginning to a certain extent, and in this regard, the debate is going on, but in comparison to 1990s, right now, Muslim immigrants in anywhere, including Germany, had better legal rights.
Mm-hmm. Let me kind of take you back a little bit before we start talking about the most recent decades here, in terms of this interesting citizenship question. I mean, in terms of the migrants that are coming in the 1950s and 1960s, I mean, was there any desire for them to engage in this temporary citizenship and go back? Or once they came there, they decided to stay and then have families? Or did they actually bring their families to begin with, or what's going on here?
I think it depends. And many people were ambivalent. They didn't. I don't think they knew exactly what they would be doing. And even today, there are so many differences. For example, in terms of religion, many immigrants follow the national attitudes. For example, when I look at the church participation ratios, for example, in the United States, Muslim immigrants just follow the general trend, and 40%, it is almost the same of the U.S. average of church attendance. The mosque attendance of Muslims in the United States is 40%, but in France, the Muslims' mosque attendance on Friday prayer for men, 10%, which is the equivalent of the church attendance in the French society in average.
So it's pretty low, and they're mirroring essentially what is going on.
Exactly, yeah. That's very interesting, which shows that Muslims do not consider a monolithic bloc in Europe, but they follow the local context, very much shaped by the culture they live in. Yes, many of them keep the Muslim culture, at least as a cultural identity, but at the same time, they reflect the French, German, or British local culture.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting in terms of their citizenship, too, because they're often portrayed in political circles, and we'll get to some of the political debates and how the parties view these different groups, in very distinct ways, and as you say, they oftentimes are assimilating or at least adjusting to different aspects of the culture around him. Let me ask you about the citizenship, though, because this is one interesting question for me that you mentioned in the early 1990s in Germany, there was a change that allowed them citizenship. In Britain, it's much easier to get citizenship. And in France, I don't know, it seems to be a little bit middle ground there. But what kind of citizenship rights did these migrants have, and more specifically their children who are born in France or born in Paris, have never stepped foot on Algerian territory. What kind of rights do they have as citizens throughout this period?
We have a recent book written by Mark Moorhead Howard, Georgetown University political scientist, and the book is entitled The Politics of Citizenship in Europe, which is a very good comparative analysis, which shows the variation with some general trend toward more liberalization in Europe. Mm-hmm. What he argues is that paradoxically or counterintuitively, the colonial legacy helps. In countries where there is a colonial legacy, laws are more liberal. But at the same time, there is a left-wing, right-wing competition, the political wrangling. In terms of your specific question, the primary issue for the Muslim immigrants was to receive citizenship, and instead of being a minority immigrant status, to be the full-fledged part of the country and society. Right now, in many cases, they went beyond it, and now they claim political representation. Now, the debate is that if, for example, the Muslims in France constitute 8% of society, do we see 8% of deputies in the French parliament? In this kind of situation, definitely there are many criteria. For example, the election system, and then the party system. It is very difficult for minorities to be politically represented in a bipartisan system as we do have in the United States or mm-hmm. UK has. But in a multi-party system, it is relatively easier for them to be represented. And right now we have many cases like Netherlands, Belgium, in which there are Muslims, observing Muslims, even women wearing headscarf in the local parliament or even national parliaments of the country. Therefore, Muslims in many cases receive the right to citizenship, and beyond that, they are now claiming political representation.
Mm-hmm. Let's give us a perspective on what that landscape looked like in terms of, you had mentioned 8% in France and such. How is the Muslim migrant population distributed across Europe? Is it evenly distributed, or is there some countries that more? You had already mentioned that there are certain ethnicities based on colonial legacy go to certain areas, Turks in Germany, Pakistanis.
If we look at Europe in a very broad sense, there are countries in the Balkans, like Bosnia and then Kosovo, Albania, definitely they are Muslim majority or half Muslim, half Muslim. Then in some other countries like Poland and Hungary, there are few very old and ancient Muslim minorities. But beyond that, when scholars generally focus on the Western Europe and then the new immigrants since the Second World War, we have been talking to. So the population of Muslims, so the highest percentage is in France, 8%, and then about 5 million. And then it's followed by Germany and UK, then followed by Spain, Italy, and Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So all six of these countries have 1 million or more Muslim immigrants. And then in addition to their increasing number, Muslims also become more visible in the economic area and then political arena. Because when they came, they were mostly blue-collar maximum or workers and then low experience and low-skilled jobs. But right now, the second, third generations are going to better schools and having university education and having their own corporations. Mm-hmm. So they became more and more flourish in economic arena, which make them, on the one hand, which makes them more successful and integrated. But on the other hand, it creates a certain level of anti-immigrant feelings among the right-wing groups, especially in the time of economic crisis. Who is the most likely scapegoat? Generally, the immigrants, right?
Right.
And it is not confined to Muslim issue. Immigrants, it doesn't matter whether Muslim or Christian, they are blamed in countries like Spain, Portugal, Greece, whenever there is an economic crisis. They are blamed for bringing poverty and then taking
In terms of that, focusing again on the demographic issues and getting into this issue of economic crisis, typically the way that the immigrant population is portrayed, and you gave us a different picture here, so this I want to explore this a little deeper, that the immigrants are seen as blue-collar working class, but that's not necessarily the case. Also, the other image that we're given of immigrants is that they tend to be younger than the average European population, that they tend to have more children on average. What's your take on these other demographic criteria in order to get a view for when we talk about the political situation?
Yeah, the best example I know is France, and in which I agree with the idea that the Muslim immigrants in France have a larger young population and then larger families. Instead of being related to culture or religion, I think this phenomenon has something to do with being a rural background or not integrated into economy perfectly. Therefore, it's a kind of self-defense mechanism for families to produce more children.
Right.
And then it's the muscle and the based understanding of economy still in their mind, therefore having children, especially boys, helpful to economy. But I think that the more they integrated to society, the more they embrace different ideas, including atomic families with one or two children and then busy life, and then the average of the young age will increase rather than being good. But Europe has the paradox at this point. On the one hand, they say it's enough, no more immigrants needed. On the other hand, it's an aging society. They need young labor. And that's the paradox Europe faces right now.
Yeah, it's something I do want to explore here, as you mentioned with the demographic issue. What we have seen, and there's been some research done on this, is that the average family size of immigrant populations starts to shrink or move toward the typical European average after about a generation or so, where you start to see the adjustment and stuff. But you're right about this paradox, and I think this sets up a really interesting political tension that we put our finger on earlier, and I want to explore this more, is that European society filled with some very large social welfare states, and a lot of the social welfare has to do with pensions and retirement funds, social security type issues, healthcare. Healthcare usually affects older populations. And what the European societies have experienced over the past several decades is a significantly aging native European population, wherein you have fewer European families having children below the typical replacement rate. They talk about 2.1. So the population's getting much older. That places a heavy fiscal burden on the younger population, which now has to support this aging population through a number of welfare policies and such.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so this right there, that sets up the need for young immigrant labor. So on the one hand, you would think that European society is going to be embracing these young immigrants open arms, saying thank you for helping fund our welfare system. But on the other hand, as you mentioned before, immigrants are blamed for a whole set of social ills when the economy goes south. So how is this playing out politically?
Politically, actually, it is open to manipulation, unfortunately, because in 2001, there was the presidential election in France, and Chirac, the incumbent president, only received 20% of the votes. Mm-hmm. And then the incumbent prime minister running for presidency received only 17%. And then who came the second with 18%? It was the far-right, racist, anti-immigrant, Jean-Marie Le Pen's National Front. So in a country like France, who is proud of its liberal values, you see the second candidate running for presidency is Jean-Marie Le Pen, is a far-right party. Why? Because the French people were in a reaction to several issues, especially the immigration issue. Therefore, they just show their reaction in the ballot box, which is really surprising for the other parts of the Europe. But then, since then, in many other countries, this example is repeated. For example, in Austria, another far-right party, I think it became the first party, not the second. Mm-hmm. And then in Netherlands, which was kind of the multiculturalism. A right-wing party, very, very far-right party, became very popular.
And that was associated with Pim Fortuyn,
exactly.
I believe. Yeah. And again, the Netherlands are the place where you would think multicultural attitudes would be embraced the most, but they have seen to take a rather strong anti-immigration turn in recent years.
Yes, and also the European confusion is reflected in different areas, including the rejection of European Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Right now they have in big disagreement, and then the immigrant issue is part of it, but beyond that, so Europe is far different from United States on this issue in terms of having consistency and clear mind and etc.
Well, talk to us a little bit more about this issue of the European Constitution. What does it say on paper and in terms of immigration, and how are different nations reacting to this that puts it in contradistinction to the Constitution?
I analyze the writing process of the document in terms of state-religion relations.
Mm-hmm.
Because initially, countries like the representatives of countries like Poland argued that God should have a place, if not Christianity or religion in general. And then France and some other secularist representatives from countries like France or others harshly opposed it, saying that no, we will not allow God or Christianity or religion have a place in the Constitution. And finally, they tried to find a middle ground, mentioning that the humanitarian and cultural, maybe implicitly they also say religion, maybe explicitly, religious origins and then backgrounds of Europe is recognized.
Mm-hmm.
But then beyond this issue, they let church-state issues to the states to decide, because, you know, right now, the European systems are very mixed. You have England, Scotland, and then Greece, Denmark, and Scandinavian countries, except Sweden very recently. They all have established churches. And then France is an exception by being the only country which explicitly defines the state as secular in the Constitution. Then the others are in the middle ground. In terms of Catholic countries like Italy, Spain, and Portugal, they don't have Catholicism established, but they signed the Concordat with the Catholic Church, which provides certain privileges and prerogatives to the Catholic Church. Ireland is an exception by not signing a Concordat, but the Constitution of Ireland, the preamble, starts with referring to Jesus Christ and the Trinity. Therefore, it's a whole mixed and diverse continuity of church-state relations, and the Constitution just let the government decide and design respecting each and every model. And similarly, for the immigration issue, there was no particular policy imposed. They're just basic principles about human rights, labor rights, etc.
Mm-hmm. So let's explore this a little bit more in terms of the church-state issues here. I know in Germany there's a situation set up where the government will go out and help fund either the Lutheran Church or the Catholic Church, and places like Belgium, we've seen similar situations in that. When Muslims walk into this environment through immigration and stuff, how do they get incorporated or not into these different church-state relations? You might want to go country by country or so.
That's a complex issue, and I think the best book on this issue is Soper and Fetzer's Muslims and the State in Britain, Germany, and France, in which they argue that countries generally reflect their early relationship with the Christian churches when it comes to their new relation with the Muslims, and therefore UK, out of the three, has the best accommodationist policies because it already accommodated different churches, especially Anglican Church, when Muslims came with demands of constructing mosques, opening religious courses or classes, even in public schools. The British state was tolerating and accommodating their demands because it had this habit and cultural and institutional legacy of tolerating such religious demands. When it came France, there was no religious teaching in school. States at all. And by the way, France and United States are the two exceptions in the Western democracies in which there is no religious teaching in public schools.
And that's something I really want to highlight for our listening audience, because we oftentimes think of European society being a very secular society, so religion has been removed from almost every aspect of the public sphere. But really, when you look at it, again, there are a number of established churches. There's a number of churches that do get funding from the government in terms of their, you know, buildings, etc. And then also, as you mentioned, religion is part of the public school system.
Yes, either obligatory or optional.
Yeah, again, with the exception of France, and then, you know, across the ocean here in the United States, which is somewhat interesting.
Unique, yeah.
So, in terms of you know, how governments have historically approached this, let's get to France in a second, but some of these other countries, how does the German government or the British government or Belgium, whatever country you'd like to use an example, how do they try to incorporate Islam into their standard view of the world? And is there any problem with that?
Yeah. So if we went back to the three-country comparison, UK is the most accommodationist, France is the most exclusionary, and then Germany in between, because Fetzer and Soper argue that in terms of church-state relations, Germany was in between because, as you rightly mentioned, it collects church tax, but there is no established church. It is less religious than UK, less secular than France in between. And in terms of relations with Muslims, similarly, there are Islamic instruction in public schools. If the Muslims demand, the state provides. It's better than France on this point. Mm-hmm. And more Islamic schools allowed than France, because in France there are only three. But in Netherlands and UK, there are hundreds of Muslim schools. That's not the case in Germany. More than France, but much less than Britain and Netherlands. Therefore, it's in between. How do they manage? So there are both cultural and institutional issues and ideological issues. So in France, there is an ideology that I call assertive secularism.
Yeah, what is that concept, assertive secularism? You make good use of that in your book.
Yeah.
Kind of explain what that is.
So I define secular state with two general criteria. First, there is no official church or no official religion. And second, laws are not religiously imposed. Or in other words, there is no religious institution that can intervene to parliament and courts while making laws or having judicial processes. So in this regard, based on the two criteria, no official religion, no religious institution to control legal system. Iran and Saudi Arabia are not secular because they have Islam official religion and they have Sharia courts or the supreme leader in Iran which control or at least check this legal system.
Mm-hmm.
If we put this religious state aside, then we have countries like United Kingdom, Greece, Denmark, which fulfill one criterion, which is that the legal system is secular. There is no supreme leader, no Christian court to control legal system. But they don't fulfill the other criteria, which is no official religion. They have established religion. Therefore, these are states with established church. They are not secular. And then we have secular states like France, United States, Turkey, Netherlands, in which the state and constitution follow both criteria, no official religion, no religious institutional control over legal system. And if you keep going in the continuum, there are some extreme cases like China, North Korea, Cuba, in which religions are somehow, by and large, persecuted. There is a kind of atheistic and anti-religious sentiment in the official discourse or documents. So if you look at the French assertive secularism and try to understand how it affected state policy toward Muslims, until the Hatzkaff debate in 1989, the French right and left was almost evenly divided. The left was promoting assertive secularism. According to assertive secularism, the state state plays an assertive role to exclude religion from public domain and confine religion to people's private life. Whereas in countries like United States, Netherlands, India, and Canada, there is passive secularism in which the state plays a passive role and tolerates either religious or non-religious symbols, discourses, and way of life in the public life.
Mm-hmm.
So the assertive secularist in France, generally the left-wing parties, politicians, and activists, and right-wing parties and politicians and activists, generally were kind of pro-Catholic and then tolerating more religious in public domain.
And I just want to break in here because you do an excellent job in your book of showing where this emanates from. You take it all the way back to the French Revolution.
Exactly.
And show how the left really is the assertive secularists want to push religion out of there. The right is the pro-Catholic parties. And then, as you note here, and you're going into this, this things start to shift a little bit.
Yes, because until the headscarf debate, 1989, until the Muslim population became an issue in France, these two sides, left and right, assertive secularists and pro-Catholics, were almost 50% when they debate the Catholic schools, for example. One side, the assertive secularists, opposed the state funding of Catholic schools in France. But the other side, the right-wing parties and politicians, after the 1959 Debre law, succeeded to provide state funding of Catholic schools, and today 20% of all kids in France are attending private schools, and 95% of the private schools are Catholic schools. And then whenever they sign a contract with the state provides all salaries of the teachers, which constitute about 80% of their entire budget, which is another thing that we cannot think in the United States, that the state funding of religious schools, which is unthinkable.
Yes,
but
yeah.
That's the case in France. 80% of budget of the Catholic schools, 20% of all students are attending to those schools, are state funding. So the debate went on this issue until the headscarf. When the headscarf issue came out, there happens a new coalition. The left wing, the left divided, mostly remain assertive secularists, but multiculturalist leftists say it's enough, that's a religious minority, we should not oppress them that much. And they moved to more American-type passive secularism, but they were a minority within the left, the multiculturalist left. Similarly, in the right, the multiculturalist right moved to passive secularism, agree with multiculturalist left, and 30% of the French public supported the right to wear headscarves. But 70% opposed it. 70% said that no, there should be a ban in public schools against wearing headscarves. And this 70% was constituted by the left-wing assertive secularists and right-wing anti-immigrants, or one may call some of them Islamophobes. So in this regard, a new phenomenon in France, two old enemies, the left-wing assertive secularists and right-wing anti-immigrants or far-right, came together, agree on the particular ban on headscarves, and first the courts opposed. For 15 years, there was no general ban. 15 years debate, and then the Supreme Court of Appeal on Administrative Issues in France, which is called the Council of State, Conseil d'État, it opposed the ban. There's analyzed case by case. For example, 42 cases reached to the Council of State, Conseil d'État. Only in 9 of them, it approved the expulsion of students because of their protesting and then harming the order, etc. But in other 33 cases, it said, no, you should tolerate the headscarf of this student. That's why in 2004, after 15 years of debate, the coalition of left-wing assertive secularists and right-wing anti-immigrants brought a law in the parliament, passed the law, and bypassed the court decisions, and banned the headscarf. But even in this radical policy, there is still freedom for Muslim wearing headscarf because they ban only in public high schools. It's free in private schools. It's free in universities, which makes, interestingly, a Muslim-majority country, Turkey, more radical than France, because in Turkey, still, headscarf, wearing headscarf, is banned in both public schools and private schools, and both schools and universities. So let me sum up this issue with referring to Germany. Germany is a country where there is no assertive secularism, at least it's not that as strong as France has. Therefore, when the anti-immigrant right tried to impose headscarf ban, it couldn't find an ally or a usable discourse as the right-wing French politicians did in France, because there was no assertive secularist left ideology or political activist in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they failed to impose any ban on students. For students, it's free in Germany. They only imposed a ban on teachers in public schools in Germany, and it only imposed in 8 out of 16 German provinces, or let's say states.
Right, the Land, yeah.
And then when you analyze the rationale of headscarf ban, in France it is secularism, religious symbols in general, Sikh turban, Muslim headscarf, Jewish kippah, and the Christian large crosses.
Yeah, let me stop you right there. That going back to France, that ban that they enacted in 2004, I mean, where as I assume that the front of everybody's mind was thinking about Muslim immigrants, I think the way they had to write the policy to make it, I don't know, more palatable or more consistent with their previous legislation on religion, they had to ban crucifixes and the kippah for Jews and such. Is that correct?
Yes, and also turban for Sikhs.
Right, for the Sikhs.
Yeah, but when it came to reality, only two Sikh students with turban were expelled from schools, and 46 Muslim headscarf wearers, and generally the more targeted Muslim headscarf and secondarily Sikh turban, but in legal terms, yes, all religious symbols, which is not the case in Germany. In the German laws, 8 out of 16 provinces ban teaching wearing headscarf per se, not religious laws. And the rationale was not secularism, but they define it against the Oriental civilization, or some German state define it against the Christian civilization. So therefore, it shows that how assertive secularism play a role in France, not in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of interesting in that regard. How has the headscarf ban been received in France since 2004? Has there been any additional conflict, any movement away back from that? How about enforcement, etc.?
Actually, it was a very much ideological and symbolic war going on, because the number of Muslim girls wearing headscarf was around 1,400.
A very small sliver.
Yeah, 1,400 students, and the entire France debated it for 15 years. And after the ban, some of the students just gave up and removed the headscarf, at least in classroom. Many moved to Catholic schools, because Catholic schools, by agreement, should accept any religion with any denominational identity. And then it's free to wear headscarf or religious symbols. Therefore, many girls moved to Catholic schools, and few of them changed their country or unfortunately just gave up education entirely. So no more protestation or other things, because Muslims in France politically are not very powerful. In the entire French assembly of 535 members, there are zero Muslim deputy with Muslim background at least. And in the French Senate, I think about 300 senators. There are only two with North African origin.
Mm-hmm. In terms of that, excuse me, how that's playing out in other policy arenas, as you mentioned, the headscarf issue really seems to be a symbolic one. And we saw protests after this was enacted, and, you know, signs up there from both sides saying we want to wear it, ban it, etc. Have there been other areas of policy that have affected Muslims, especially those who want to practice their religion openly or be more free to practice their religion? What other arenas of policy have affected them?
Yeah, we already mentioned the lack of religious instruction in France, including for Muslims and non-Christians, both. And then the number of Islamic schools recently increased just 4, very small schools in comparison to other European countries, Netherlands, UK and Germany. The Muslims are in a disadvantage, therefore they move to Catholic schools because the bureaucratic restrictions in France didn't let them to have their own Islamic schools. And then beyond that, the mosque construction is also another problematic area. So if you happen to be in Paris on a Friday, especially if you move around in a neighborhood where there's a small mosque, it is very hard for you to travel because the streets are full of people praying. So even Sarkozy recently became unhappy with this fact, but it's related to the fact that Muslims do not have sufficient prayer space. So one may say that it is because of the financial issues. Yes, but there is also the bureaucratic restrictions that the many mayors or the local bureaucrats oppose to see a mosque or even without minaret in the French public or urban sphere. Therefore, Muslims have also a disadvantage, which is not the case in UK or Germany or United States. We have many large mosques in the United States, which is not the case in France.
So let me probe that a little bit more. And I do think we covered this a little bit in comparative perspective earlier. But in the United Kingdom, mosque construction doesn't seem to be a big deal, nor does the issue of schools, the construction of Muslim schools, seem to be a big problem. Why there and not France? And what does the German situation look like?
So first of all, there are alternative ways of thinking. One may think that Muslims in UK, for example, are more politically powerful and perhaps more moderate guys, therefore they have more rights, and then local leaders respect their rights, which is not the case in France. Does that help us to understand? No, definitely not, because Muslims in France are more moderate. There are more radical Muslims in UK, unfortunately. And then in terms of political power, both are very weak. Very limited political representation and resources for mobilization.
Right.
Then who makes the decision? Actually, it's the local leaders and local groups wrangling and competing and debating and making the decision, regardless of Muslims' own political power. So one way of dealing with this issue is the British understanding of negative freedom. So Isaac Berlin defined negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from outside oppression, but positive freedom is freedom to do something. So in Britain, that's the general liberal tradition, that the state is not supposed to intervene to your religiosity, to your cultural practice, etc. Therefore, it recognizes and respects Muslim as a different group. Even during the colonial era, we talk about the impact of colonialism, but there are two types of colonialism, the British and the French. Britain generally recognized local cultures, and then religious laws were permitted, even sometimes encouraged under the British rule. But in the French case, there is a strong still and legacy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and then his understanding of the general will. So the general will is not the combination of particular interests, but it represents the interest of all. And one can be or should be forced to be free. So the emancipation by oppression is something good in this French Republican understanding of positive freedom. So you should be emancipated by being a part of the general body. Therefore, difference and then religious visibility are not accepted because the public school is something to homogenize. It's something to assimilate, integrate. It's not a place you reflect your difference, but you are supposed to reflect your unity and solidarity and similarity. So therefore, there is a big difference between the British liberal culture or ideological tradition based on negative freedom and difference and respect to religious visibility, and then the French understanding of the general will and then positive freedom and homogeneity. And then during the French colonization of Algeria, the French colonizers really tried to assimilate by imposing certain secular values.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, as we just follow the news about Tunisia and Algeria, these are the two hardliners countries in the Muslim world in terms of imposing secular values to their own people. Tunisia and Turkey are the two countries which have this headscarf ban, and Tunisia was a French colony. Turkey was not, but Turkey intellectually was influenced by France. Therefore, the French policy is not confined by the French territory per se, but it even has had the impact on the Muslim-majority countries as well in terms of this mentality and ideology.
You brought up Turkey, and I did want to talk about that because your book brings Turkey into this dialogue, and it's an interesting case, you know, dating back to the 1920s with Kemal Atatürk and the imposition of a more westernized view. And today we see Turkey as straddling two different worlds here. That it wants to be part of the European Union. It's a predominantly Muslim country, and it has it's a very secular state. Tell us a little bit about how Turkey fits into all of this. How does it deal with mosque-state relations? How has it been changing recently, and how might this work into its integration with the European Union?
So recently, when people discuss, the pundits and the scholars discuss Egypt, they also emphasize that Turkey can become a model for Egypt too. Why? Because, as you rightly mentioned, from 20s until 1990s, Turkey was regarded as an example of secularization and modernization, urbanization, literacy ratios, and then industrialization would wither religion away and make a secular state in the Muslim world, as it already did in Europe. That was the idea of modernization theories. And what do we have an example? Yes, we do. It is Turkey, they say. But recently, even the many American and European scholars realized that that's not the case. Why? Because there was the myth of urban Turkey, that there was the elite, Europeanized, westernized, secularized, kind of cut their ties with the Islamic tradition. But the masses were different. And then there was the gap in Turkey between the European type elite and more traditional mass. But for the last 20 years, the gap was shrinking. And right now, almost it disappeared. The rural people moved to cities. We talk about immigration to Europe, and what happened in Turkey was immigration to cities.
Mm-hmm.
And then many traditional people send their kids to good schools and universities. Even recently, they move around and then started to send their children to different countries. And then they really integrated to European Union and then world economy. Right now what we are seeing in Turkey is actually like the Republican Party, socially conservative, economically very liberal group of people emerge. And now the ruling party, the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, I argue that the party is not Islamist, but it is a pro-Islamic conservative, and it tried to promote passive secularism and try to remove assertive secularism from Turkey. And economically, they are very liberal, like freedom, free market economy. But conservative, they are pious people living a conservative way of life. And what we are seeing in Turkey for the last 3 years, a big power change, because until 2007, there was the military tutelage over democracy, because only 25% of the people support assertive secularist policies, such as Ben Scott Ben. 75% of the people oppose these policies. They want to lift the headscarf ban. And they are not Islamists, because the percentage of people in Turkey who want a Sharia state, Islamic law as the law of the land, only 9%. And according to some survey, it is similar of the 9% of Americans who want to see Bible as the law of the land. So 91% support secular state, but the question, what type of secularism should it be? So only a quarter of society support assertive secularism, but although they are minority, it is an organized minority supported by judiciary and military, therefore they have been able to keep certain restrictive laws against the Hezbollah, against the graduates of Islamic schools not entering to university departments, against the teaching of the Quran on their kids 15 years old, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But since 2007, democratization really helped the masses or the traditional people mobilize. And then they changed the laws, and then 4 months ago, they even amended the Constitution, made the judicial system more bottom-up rather than it was formerly top-down structure. And now they are removing the restriction one by one, and I think Turkey is moving from assertive secularism to passive secularism. So what does that tell us for the rest of the world? I think a Turkey which embraces passive secularism, tolerates religion, will become a good model for the Middle Eastern countries in particular and Muslim countries in general. Because if we leave Muslim countries in a hard decision of between Iranian-type Islamic Sharia and French-type assertive secularism, many would prefer Iran to France. Therefore, there should be a middle ground, a better model between the two extremes. And Turkey in the future may provide such a model, showing that it's not either or, but there's always a gray zone, a middle ground between assertive secularism and Sharia state.
The shift between assertive secularism toward a passive secular model in Turkey is absolutely fascinating. You do a great job documenting that in much of your work. Is that somehow scaring some of the folks in France? Because from what I read in France, your work on the ideological models of people in the elite who make these policies, for them to see this passive secularism, they must think it as a move toward a religious state rather than as just a neutral state like in the United States. So how is Europe viewing this move in Turkey?
Actually, you are definitely right, because about 2 years ago, a law professor who drafted the new constitution for Turkey, when I was a postdoc at Columbia, we invited him, and he came there and then embraced the idea of passive secularism. When he went back, he gave an interview to a major Turkish newspaper saying that Turkey one day will become passive secularist, and then to Ahmet Kuru coined this term.
Mm-hmm.
And they attacked him as sort of secularist in the media, and they attacked me. They published my photograph, and beneath it they wrote, "Passive secularism from Ahmet Kuru made in USA." So, and then they think that it is bad for promoting a tolerant secularism, and it is extra, it is worse when it is made in USA. So, but I think in both France and United States, there are people who appreciate the American model, and there are people who understand how liberal it is in comparison to Turkish and the French model. And if you look at the French and Turkish models, they are full of contradictions and exceptions. For example, in Turkey they say it's a secular state, but all imams in 70,000 mosques are state employees, paid by the state. What kind of secular state is this, right? It is so paradoxical, because the state doesn't want Islam to become free and separated. Assertive secularists wanted to minimize Islam's role in public domain by controlling all the mosques.
Mm-hmm.
But the result is so contradictory what they are telling. In France, they say it is a secular state, more secular than the United States, they think, but we already mentioned how they fund the Catholic schools. Then, an important region, Alsace-Moselle, which includes Strasbourg, there is no secularism. It is an exceptional region in which the bishop is appointed by the president of France, and then there are crucifixes in classroom, etc. And they even impose the headscarf ban in that particular region, which is another phenomenon to be explained in the French secularism.
Mm-hmm.
Or half of the French public schools have Catholic chaplains, and on Fridays they serve fish instead of meat because the Catholics don't want to eat meat on Fridays. So when we have a long list of exceptions in the French secularism, therefore when the American model or passive seekers model proposed, they should not be scared because there are so many things to be fixed in the existing model.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a very interesting paradox that many people don't understand of the European system. They see it as a very secular state, and you take France as the excellent example of that. But nonetheless, the ties between religion and state are still very intense in many ways that we don't see. Let me close out here with some of your reflections on the United States, because that in your last book, you use that as your third case study. We talked about France, we talked about Turkey, a number of other European countries. But in terms of the United States, you mention it as a passive secular society. In terms of relations with Muslim immigrants here in the United States, do you see the same kind of problems that Europe is having, or is it somehow different?
Yes and no. So yes, there are similar trends like Islamophobia, and then when we discuss the Islamic cultural center in Lower Manhattan, although Manhattan people in average support this project, the U.S. public survey shows that 60% of people in the United States in average oppose it. So there's a certain level of concern about Muslims, yes. But at the same time, U.S. system is so dynamic. And in the future, I think this kind of prejudices and stereotypes will be solved, because if you look at the historical trajectory, you know better than me, but let me explain a little bit. In an earlier era, there was state neutrality in the United States basically meant neutrality toward all Protestant denominations. It wasn't state neutrality toward Jews or Catholics. But by the early 20th century, by the end of Prohibition and the Monkey Trial and this kind of debate, shows a change in the United States in which the Protestant non-denominational Protestant cultural domination started to decline. And then there, by 1950, by Eisenhower era, it was the Cold War beginning against the godless communism, etc. And there emerged a new monotheistic establishment, which embrace Catholics and Jews, but still emphasis on monotheism. But by 1960s, the Supreme Court decision prohibiting Bible reading and prayer helped the swifting pendulum toward more secularization again.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently, the integration of Catholics and Jews to American mainstream became finalized, and the best data about it we have is that in the Supreme Court right now we have 6 Catholics judges and 3 Jews and 0 Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it tell us? It tells us that today some groups like Muslims and Mormons and atheists may have certain level of disadvantages when people are asked whether they would accept a Muslim president or Mormon or atheist. 30%, 35% say no. But in the long run, as Jews and Catholics were embraced and then integrated, my hope is that Muslims would be integrated too to the American mainstream, because the Muslims in America, in comparison to Muslims in Europe, are better educated, and they are in better jobs, and they are better well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And even certain surveys argue that the average annual wage salary of Muslims is higher than the average American salary.
Yeah, in part, the immigration, Muslim immigration to this country.
Yeah, because better educated people came to here. Maybe it is hard to bypass the ocean for those who don't have money and education.
It's a longer trip.
Yes.
It's more costly, but also we don't have the colonial legacy in some of these parts as, say, France does, where there's a direct conduit. But
When I presented my project a few years ago in Paris, and some French students were so annoyed, and then they were saying that, oh, you over romanticize American system and too much critical of French system. And then let us know about what happened to Muslims after September 11, because thousands of them were not persecuted, but screened because of racial profiling.
Right.
Then I taught them that it wasn't because of passive secularism, but it was despite passive secularism in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, there was a terrorist attack, so certain emotions and anti-Muslim feelings, but if we didn't had not had passive secularism, things would have been worse for Muslims in this country.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting thought to finish up on there, and there were reflections on Europe and the United States as well as Turkey in there as well. We greatly appreciate you being on our podcast, Research on Religion, and your research agenda has been incredibly dynamic. And as you say, you're getting a lot of attention throughout the world with what you're doing. And the fact that you were one of my former students, I have to mention this at the end, makes me very proud of all the work that you've been doing. So we wish you the best in your future research, and I'm sure we'll have you back on again. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for your continued support on my research agenda. It was my pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.